For South Carolina Public Radio, I'm Felicia Eady, and this is The Road We Trod, the impact of South Carolina's HBCUs on history, the economy, and the future.
One more time.
Earlier this month, on the campus of South Carolina State University in Orangeburg, students paid tribute to the victims of the Orangeburg Massacre. They held a reenactment march from campus to the site of a once-segregated bowling alley. The crowd of students stopped at various spots on the 150-year-old campus. The first was at a monument honoring the three students killed during what has become known as the Orangeburg Massacre in 1968.
Offer you guys a challenge. At the end of the day, with Smith, Hammond, and Milton, would they be proud of our Bulldog pride? Would they be proud of our Bulldog pride?
That's Israel Robinson. He's a senior at South Carolina State, majoring in social work. Robinson is about the same age that Samuel Hammond, Henry Smith, and Delano Middleton were when they were gunned down by South Carolina Highway Patrol on South Carolina State's campus 51 years ago.
Our students have always stood up for what is right. At the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves this question.
That horrific event, the Orangeburg Massacre, is known as one of the most violent episodes of the civil rights movement. It was the country's first deadly confrontation between law enforcement and students. The Kent State and Jackson State shootings followed almost 2 years, 3 months later.
African Americans were pretty adamant that an essential part of being free and being a free citizen was to have education at every level.
Dr. Bobby Donaldson is a professor at the University of South Carolina. He's done extensive research into African American history. Currently, the university has exhibits in various parts of the Columbia area that focus on the contributions of HBCUs to the civil rights movement.
If you look at the history of Claflin, or the history of Benedict, or the history of Allen University, those schools have their origins in that window of time following emancipation, where African-American community leaders recognize that to really fully realize the goals of freedom and emancipation, people needed to be educated.
There are 8 historically black colleges and universities in South Carolina. The oldest is Claflin University in Orangeburg. It was founded in 1869. Allen University and Benedict College in Columbia were both founded in 1870. Clinton College in Rock Hill was founded in 1894. South Carolina State University in Orangeburg was founded in 1896. Voorhees College in Denmark, 1897. Morris College in Sumter, 1908. And Denmark Technical College, South Carolina's only state-supported HBCU, was founded in 1944. Each of these institutions have played a pivotal role in shining a light into the dark of the country's oppressive and unequal past. Students at Clinton College were background supporters of the Friendship Nine. Claflin University and South Carolina State students were attempting to protest the segregated All-Star Triangle Bowl before the Orangeburg Massacre took place. Students at Benedict College and Allen University and Morris College organized and held numerous events that educated people on fighting injustice, including a very important meeting that took place in Columbia. Again, Dr. Donaldson.
One clear example of this is a big event that happens at the Township Auditorium in Columbia in 1946. It was called the Southern Negro Youth Congress. And these were African American students from around the country and white students who gathered at the township to strategize about ways to address inequity and discrimination. And they meet at Benedict College and Allen University, and the keynote speakers for the occasion were Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson. And they are charging these young college students and high school students to go out and to begin to address these inequities. And then as the years move forward, African American colleges play a critical role in the civil rights struggle. From sit-ins at lunch counters throughout the South and throughout South Carolina to downtown street demonstrations to public protests, they play a role.
Another event led by HBCU students took place at the State House in 1961.
187 students are arrested and convicted for disturbing the peace while protesting at the State House. And those students are from Claflin, South Carolina State, Allen University, Benedict College, and high schools around the state. They are arrested for disturbing the peace, And what makes this arrest so unique is that in 1963, the United States Supreme Court, in a case called Edwards v. South Carolina, overturns the conviction of these young men and women. That case becomes an important legal case in other civil rights struggles around the country thereafter. Among the persons arrested that day was a college student at South Carolina State named James Clyburn. And he, along with others, recognized that this demonstration and arrest was a pivotal moment, not only in South Carolina, but around the country.
And then there was the economic impact on the local economy.
So they're producing individuals and leaders, some who are trained in the traditional liberal arts, but they are also producing skilled craftspeople and skilled people in agriculture and mechanics who are going on to establish businesses in South Carolina and elsewhere.
These now skilled college grads have helped create a vibrant working middle class. And Donaldson says the HBCUs they graduated from are still vital to local economies today.
I think the institutions remain critical to developing strong communities. When you look at a place like Allen University and Benedict College, they are anchors of historic communities. When you look at South Carolina State and Claflin, one can't envision Orangeburg without those schools. When you look at a community like Denmark, I mean, could Denmark be Denmark without the presence of Denmark Tech and Voorhees College? I mean, I think they're integral to the vitality of these communities.
According to a recent report by the United Negro College Fund, or UNCF, South Carolina's HBCUs have generated over $400 million in total economic impact and created both on-campus and off-campus jobs to the sum of over 4,900 positions. But despite their historic origins, ability to drive economic success, and positive influence on American history, for many of these institutions, surviving comes with struggles.
Probably the number one issue, and I think you will probably hear it over and over again, is aging infrastructure.
One of the challenges is that you have to remain in financial good standing to maintain accreditation.
And so we were competing for the same pool of students. Now those students can go wherever they want to, and you have the PWIs trying to attract them.
Those were the voices of some of the presidents of South Carolina's 8 HBCUs. In conversations with each, enrollment, fundraising, and upkeep of buildings were among common issues each college is struggling with or has struggled with in the past. But this is an issue that permeates beyond South Carolina's borders.
Today, February 1st, is the last day we have raised $3.5 million. $3.5 million. And we can do this.
Bennett College in North Carolina recently made national headlines when the all-female school was facing losing its accreditation because of financial instability. Bennett was on probation for 2 years because of this. They needed to raise $5 million. And they did. They held a bell-ringing ceremony on campus to celebrate, but they're not out of the woods yet. This week, the institution presented its case to an appeals panel, all in an effort to keep the school's accreditation with the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges. Local news outlets report a decision will be made within a week. Here in South Carolina,
right now we have about 550 students.
Dr. Christopher J. Hall is interim president at Denmark Technical College.
And that's not where it used to be.
Over the past decade, enrollment at Denmark Tech has been on a steady decline. A few years ago in 2008, the institution had over 2,200 students. So what happened?
I haven't found any one reason why enrollment went down, but we are inversely correlated with the economy. All colleges are, higher ed. And it's something that we've noticed. Whenever the economy is doing well and people can get jobs, they don't go to school. They work. When the economy goes into a recession and people lose jobs, they come back and get education for when the economy picks back up. So we're always in that cycle somewhere.
The school's history is a unique one.
Denmark Technical College is the only two-year HBCU in South Carolina. We've been here for 70 years. On March 1st, it'll be 71 years. Originally, it started as South Carolina Area Trade School, Denmark Branch. After the soldiers came back from World War II, South Carolina wanted to do something to educate those soldiers. So they created three trade schools, one in Columbia, one in Charleston, and the one here in Denmark was for the black soldiers. And so that's how we started. That was 1947. 1968, we actually became a part of the new technical college system here in South Carolina. So Denmark Tech, or South Carolina Area Trade School, was in place 20 years before the South Carolina Area technical college system. The way the technical colleges work, when they created the technical college system, they wanted a technical college within 50 miles of every South Carolina citizen. In exchange for that school or that college being located in that area, the local counties were tasked with supporting the physical plant of the college. Well, at the time, when the state created the technical college system, they said Allendale, Bamberg, and Barnwell counties could not afford to support the college. So at that time, it wasn't written into legislation that the counties had to support us. So up until last year, Denmark Tech never really received any funding to mention from the counties. But since I've been here, I've worked with the counties, and now we're starting to get some support to improve the physical plant of the college. And now there's more competition in higher ed than there's ever been. Not only do you have your four institutions, public and private, you have your two institutions, public and private, but you have your four profit institutions and a lot of online schools as well.
In 2017, Governor Henry McMaster signed a bill that temporarily transferred oversight of Denmark Tech away from the local area commission to the State Board for Technical and Comprehensive Education. Hall was hired by this board. The governor cited low enrollment, financial instability, crumbling facilities, and outdated equipment for his decision. Oversight has since been returned to the local area commission, and Hall says the school is once again working to return Denmark Tech on a positive path.
Denmark Tech is right in the middle of rural South Carolina. Allendale, Barnwell, and Bamberg counties are very rural. They have high rates of unemployment, high levels of poverty, and Denmark Tech is poised to change that. Right now, as of the study that was conducted by UNICEF in 2017, it put forth that Denmark Tech has a $32 million annual impact to this area. And so we're an economic driver because our students, they go to the stores, they go to the restaurants in this area. We use the local businesses for air conditioning repair, for all the services that we need on campus. So if Denmark Tech doesn't exist, what's going to fill that void?
That question has been asked before because there are options for higher learning in Denmark. Orangeburg Calhoun Technical College is about 30 miles away from Denmark Tech, and right across the street, is the four-year private HBCU, Voorhees College. It's affiliated with the Episcopal Church and accredited by the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools.
Let us go forth into the world rejoicing in the power of the Spirit.
Thanks be to God. Hallelujah.
On this day, faculty and staff, students, and community members attended the Absalom Jones Feast Day celebration. Was a service to recognize the African-American presence in the Episcopal Church. After, College President Dr. W. Franklin Evans talked about how Voorhees is working to better serve a growing South Carolina.
We have reopened two off-campus sites. We have an off-campus site in Charleston, South Carolina, and a second off-campus site in Augusta, Georgia. And so we reach out there, so we've got students at both sites. So they are free to take classes here on campus. They are students, but we actually take instruction out there to them.
With this combination of classes offered at the main campus and its two satellite campuses, Evans hopes to increase the school's enrollment from 494 to
certainly over 500 students. I say 525. Others have set the target at 550. Ultimately, I would like to see Voorhees at around 700.
Enrollment directly affects being able to be financially stable.
All of our institutions, for the most part, are enrollment-driven, meaning we need students in order for us to survive. I mean, that's just the truth of the matter. And so whenever there are declines in enrollment, it's a problem for us.
To solve that problem, Evans says institutions must not only look at recruitment, but also retention.
You know, there was a saying that it's cheaper to keep them. It really is. So once we get the student here, we want them to stay here. We're still educating first-generation students. We're still educating students who many are the first in their family, not just to go to college, graduate from high school, which I just found it's astounding. In 2019, we still have young people who are the first to graduate from high school. We're talking about their parents my age, who didn't graduate from high school. And so for them to graduate from high school and now to come to college and navigate on a playing field that's so totally different, and to have no one in the household who understands college life.
And that sheds light on yet another issue that impacts the viability of South Carolina's HBCUs. We spoke with Dr. Ernest McNeely, president of Allen University in Columbia, by phone. He says there are a multitude of reasons a student may have difficulty staying enrolled.
And most of those reasons are brought to the campus with the student when the student arrives.
Dr. McNeely says there is a fair amount of research that indicates two facts that impact a student's level of persistence to complete college is not being studied very well. Those are academic confidence and intent.
Students who believe they can do well typically do well. And then the other issue is intent. When a student goes off to college, do they intend to, in fact, study a particular discipline with the expectation that they will enter into a particular profession? And so oftentimes, that is not the case.
McNeely adds, often students arrive on campus not because they have a clear career goal in mind, but because
it is the next thing to do after graduation.
McNeely says Allen uses a combination of nurture and strategy to address this issue.
Well, obviously, we cannot undo the experience that students bring. Certainly, one would hope that they would arrive with some sense of where it is they're trying to go. But certainly, as I think many institutions are doing, we lay out a path in terms of what professions are available. As a matter of fact, we actually have an electronic assessment tool to help students understand, based on where they are when they arrive, as to what route they may take in terms of a career path. But it is an issue that, again, as I suggested, arrives on the campus, and it's very difficult to within 3 semesters to redress habits and habits of mind that would have been developed over 18 years.
HBCUs are known for what many call nurturing environments that not only help students find their way, but also offer home-like guidance to help ensure academic and career success. When randomly talking to alums about their decisions to attend one of South Carolina's HBCUs, this nurturing environment comes up in each response.
Tanika Hughes, and I attended Benedict College in Columbia, South Carolina. And I'm currently a broadcast journalist. I'm a main evening anchor for Action News Jax, the CBS and Fox affiliate in Jacksonville, Florida. And I've been in the news business about 15 years. Attending an HBCU was an amazing experience for me. I chose Benedict College because they had a recruiter, Walandria Jefferson, who came to my rural high school in North Carolina for a recruiting event. And I was a relatively good student, and I had been looking into different colleges. And she talked to me about Benedict, encouraged me to visit, and also mentioned that with my grades and SAT scores, it was likely that they could offer me a full academic scholarship. And coming from a family with not a lot of resources, to be able to have an offer for my education to be paid for was very appealing to me. And I had a few other colleges that were interested and also willing to offer some money, but when I visited the campus with my family, that's what really sealed it for me. I felt like it was home. It was inviting. I felt like it was an environment where I could focus on learning and not just, you know, learning about my major, but learning about myself.
My name is Brenda Strickland. I attended South Carolina State University, which was, when I was there, South Carolina State College. I am now currently a real estate broker. I own a real estate company in Metro Atlanta, and I'm also an academic coach in the educational industry. But HBCUs will always be relevant. How it's impacted me is amazing because we're constantly proving that the alumni, we're serving the community. We impact professional industries and we lead progressive movements. So it's almost like a family. It's paved the way for me and my family, and the network is just outstanding. It has helped me build character, and it's just allowed us to have pride in who we are and as a member and an alumna of an HBCU. So it's just an impactful, and it makes you feel impactful. It keeps you going. It gives you that energy you need to know that you are part of something that's great. And when I think of South Carolina State University, and whenever I hear SCSU or SCSD, there's something, it's just something happens inside of you. You're always a bulldog, and you cherish those years that you were there, and you know that when you walk out of your home or wherever your profession may be, when you leave that place, you know that it came from where I started, which is South Carolina State University. So it's just a great place to have attended.
My name is Shamela Gilliard. I'm an English teacher in Virginia. I chose South Carolina State after I received a scholarship during their centennial celebration, and it was actually the best decision that I made. My experience provided me with an opportunity to learn and to grow in a community that believed in our collective potential and fostered a sense of pride and a responsibility, really, to go out into the community and be of service and to do something greater than ourselves.
Claflin University in Orangeburg is part of a three-school cluster that's taking a strategic approach to guiding students to success.
We have a special program that we have in place. It's our Career Pathway Initiative. It's a program that was funded by UNCF and the Lilly Endowment of $6 million.
Dr. Henry Tisdale has served as president of Claflin University for the past 25 years. He retires this year. During his tenure, he's helped to guide the institution into the role of academic leader. The Career Pathways Initiative, or CPI grant, helps Claflin help students achieve academic success.
And it allows us to take students and to take those students with needs, if you will. We're here in South Carolina. We're here in rural South Carolina, if you will. And many of, even though we have students from all over the world on this campus, the majority of our students are coming from areas where they are first generation, they may even be academically challenged for whatever reason. But we have this program, Career Pathway Initiative, where we are prepared and have the resources to proactively engage these students, surrounding each student with professional advisors with mentors, with career development professionals, and with faculty who can take these students from day one, get them on a career pathway. Because students are coming from certain areas, they don't know about all of the possibilities in terms of careers.
Voorhees College and Benedict College are the other two South Carolina schools to receive the CPI grant. Claflin is the oldest HBCU in South Carolina, and throughout the years have created diverse course offerings and established a very strong academic record.
We would work to make Claflin become recognized as one of the premier liberal arts institutions in the southeastern region of the United States. So you ask the question, you know, where were we in 1994 when I arrived and where we are now? In 1994, Claflin had very little recognition. It was good, but not known for anything in particular. It was not ranked in anyone's rankings. But today, the university has a record enrollment, over 2,200 students here at Claflin University from all over the country. Every region of the country, we have strong academic programs. Our academic reputation, regionally and nationally, very strong today.
Tisdale says Claflin and other HBCUs are working to have an impact on the nation and the world.
We believe that will really serve our country and our state very well, because everywhere that we go today, you know, there is this quest for increasing the workforce in terms of diversity, increasing the diversity in the workforce. And I think the work that the HBCUs are doing and are continuing to do will serve the country well in terms of continuing to diversify the workforce.
Next door to Claflin is South Carolina State. Known for its stellar marching band, State was founded in 1896. President James E. Clark says South Carolina State is looking to continue its impact on the state by working with other institutions.
Over time, we, like other campuses, will be diversifying our student body. And a lot of times when people hear that, they think, you know, maybe just ethnic diversity. But what we mean by that is diversification by geography, by delivery mechanism, by time of delivery, by type of students, maybe more transfer, by certification type. So no matter what student, no matter who you are, no matter what your background might be, if you have an interest in course material that we have the ability to deliver, then we are a logical and wonderful candidate for you. Because as we diversify our campus body, we will both include transfers from all 16 technical colleges. We just completed transfer arrangements for the entire technical college system for students to finish their associates at the technical college and become juniors with us. And we take all those credits and apply towards the degree program.
The university also partners with Research One institutions.
Like Clemson at the graduate level. So someone could technically start at a technical college, do 2 years, and come here and then get their bachelor's degree. Or someone could come here and enter in our 3+2 program in physics, and subsequently there will be others, with Clemson, and they do 3 years on our campus, 1 year on the Clemson campus, and then they get their degree from us, and then one more year on Clemson campus, and they get a graduate degree in physics. So it's a frictionless, high-bandwidth pathway into a graduate program at a place like Clemson, and we're working on others at other institutions as well.
The president of Benedict College is Dr. Rosalind Clark Artis. She's been the head of the four-year liberal arts school for almost 2 years. Clark is the first female president of the school. In the past, Benedict College has had its share of enrollment and financial struggles. In a 2018 interview with South Carolina ETV, Dr. Artis talks about her vision for the HBCU.
I hug my students. I establish relationships with them that are very maternal at times. We're living in a Me Too culture. I doubt that my gentleman peers have the opportunity to hug their students without fear of any kind of reprisal or consequence. So there's an advantage to being a woman. They see me and I know them and they know me, and we're able to build a rapport and a relationship that I think hopefully encourages them to want to do well while they're here at Benedict College. I practiced law for a decade and rather enjoyed the practice. I think I was reasonably good at it. A good friend asked me to teach a class as an adjunct professor. I thought I know nothing of teaching, but I agreed to do it. And what I found is that the students in the classroom were very much like the jury in a box. They were there, compulsory, they had to listen, and yet not so compulsory, right? The students chose to be there. They wanted to hear what you had to say. I didn't hesitate. I resigned the practice of law, went back to school to earn another doctorate. You may know that the Juris Doctorate, the law degree, is not considered an earned doctorate, as though those are given away for Christmas for people who are good, rather than 3 years and a seat in a bar exam. But went back to Vanderbilt to earn a doctorate so that I could be competitive in higher education, and I've never looked back and never regretted it at all. I chose to lead at an HBCU because I am myself the product of an historically black college. I attended West Virginia State College, then now University in West Virginia, and found that to be an amazingly transformative experience for me. Growing up in Southern West Virginia, which is a 3% minority state, you would very often find yourself as the only person of color everywhere you went. And so arriving on that campus and seeing teachers and administration, the president, the first lady, my classmates, all of whom look like me, and the freedom that comes with being yourself. Many of our historically black colleges and universities have suffered from historic levels of underfunding, particularly those that are state-run. Our private HBCUs are like our private school peers around the country. Many of our students are low-wealth, first-generation students, for whom Pell and other sources of funding have not kept pace with increases over time. And so our students are less able to pay. Our infrastructure and technology and some of those things can be a bit dated if you have not been able to invest in them. People thought, she's insane. She's cutting tuition and capping enrollment. How will Benedict survive? Kids were getting into payment arrangements they couldn't possibly make. They had high balances that forced them to have to drop out. It was pointless. It was harming us on our financials with our bad debt reserves and our write-offs and those kinds of things. Why charge it if the customer, right, our students, can't pay it? Let's be realistic and clear about what our students can afford to pay. We'll collect it at 100% and make sure that we stabilize our cash flow and stabilize Benedict College, but not harm our kids. And that was our ultimate goal when we made the adjustment. I am a communicator. I'm a nurturer. As a mother, I tend to be in the details, so processes matter to me. How long are my students standing in line? Are grades being posted on time? Are they learning and loving, right? Are we teaching them and developing them at the same time? I think women are better with those kinds of things, and that just happens to be what Benedict needs today. I try not to wait for big things to happen, because you miss a lot of little victories along the way. So the student that stopped me this morning on my way in, and you know, she said, "Good morning, Dr. Artis." And I said, "Hi, happy first day of school." And she said, "I'm so glad to be back. I missed you." That's success for me.
Morris College is located in Sumter and is operated by the Baptist Educational Missionary Convention of South Carolina. Enrollment today sits just above 740. President Dr. Leroy Stagger says Morris is just like some of the other HBCUs in the state. It's had a significant impact on the civil rights movement and has also helped produce a thriving middle class.
There has been a very rich history of HBCUs producing young people who have become a part of the American middle class. So we have our teachers and preachers, but we also have lawyers and doctors and administrators in state and federal government, and even people in businesses and Fortune 500 companies. And so the largest percentage of leaders in America
have been produced by HBCUs, include just to name a few, like Martin Luther King Jr., Jesse Jackson. America, these HBCUs have produced leaders for America in large numbers. And so that's the part of the rich history, but also even more importantly is that it allowed the opportunity for young people to become a part, and we all know how important it is to be a part of the middle class, about the economic and the health and the all of the things that come along with that to benefit us.
But Morris also has a significant impact on South Carolina's religious front.
For many, many years, there was a school of religion at Morris College up until the mid-1990s. And we did away with it for some specific reasons to comply with SAC standards. But for many, many years, Morris trained ministers. In fact, the college was founded initially to train teachers and preachers. Now, not was, but still is. We still do. When that school of religion was discontinued, I think it was 1996, we established at the same time two academic programs, and this is pretty rare for undergraduate institutions. We have two Bachelor of Arts degree programs, one in what we call pastoral ministry, which is a preaching, a degree in preaching, and another degree in Christian education, which is a degree that is designed to produce Christian workers in the church, superintendents of Sunday schools, etc. And so that long tradition is still going on. By the way, we also have an extension program where one need not pursue a degree but can get a certificate in preaching, and that's a vibrant program. We run about 15 of those across the state of South Carolina, and the classes are offered in the evenings to make it convenient for people who are interested in. Those are for practicing preachers and pastors, people who are already in the field but want additional enrichment and understanding of the Bible. The two primary institutions that African Americans have owned in this country and control are, number one, the churches, African American churches of all the various denominations. And the other area is schools, schools of higher education, institutions of higher education. Morris College is one of about 101. And Morris College is one of 37 under the United Negro College Fund umbrella.
Stagger says HBCUs are in a unique position to educate young African Americans in the state.
Now, there are, of course, quality majority institutions that do, you know, a great job of educating. But to have a young person to find that confidence and self-esteem grounded in his or her culture. Now, it is important that young people grow and develop and be able to look beyond their own culture. But for those first 4 years of studying and developing, HBCUs do that better than any other type of institutions. And so it is not by happenstance that leadership, many of the most of the great leaders that our country have produced, and let me not forget African-American generals, have come up and through HBCUs. And so that self-esteem, that self-confidence, that inner voice that say, I can do this, is by and large for most of our African Americans were discovered, founded, and nurtured. It has to be nurtured also. Not just that it's there and you see it, but it has to be nurtured. And HBCUs are far and above the best at doing that.
President Lester McCorn calls Clinton College one of the best-kept secrets in South Carolina.
I started, like most colleges, as a School for Teachers and Preachers, and stayed small for some reason. It was just a small school, started as a normal school, which had like a high school program up until the early 60s, had a high school program. Then was a junior college and stayed a junior college up until about 5 or 6 years ago.
The school is located in Rock Hill, and like many in York County, is preparing to reap the benefits of increasingly becoming more of a suburb of Charlotte.
Clinton is one of the fastest growing HBCUs right now. Our largest freshman class came in this past year, 150 new students, and we only have 220 students. So the trajectory and the trend is good for the school. The Clinton College, because when I go out, they ask, where is Clinton College? And I say Rock Hill, and people have no idea what Rock, unless you're from South Carolina or Charlotte, you don't really know Rock Hill. And I say to people, we are 20 minutes from Charlotte, North Carolina. We're in probably the fastest growing county in the state of South Carolina, which means that the potential is enormous. It's hard to gauge it, but I would say that we have the most potential of any of the South Carolina HBCUs just because of our location, our proximity to Charlotte, because Charlotte is growing so much. So we really are now right within a major metropolitan area with great possibilities. So Rock Hill is a great place to be.
McCorn says the school is like a village.
What we like to say is that Clinton is a great place for those people who need a nurturing environment. Our teacher-to-student ratio is 13-1. And so you get a lot of personal attention, and it really is like a family. Unlike most HBCUs, it's a family. So we're really like a village community. And we usually get the students that are most challenged, who may not be necessarily quote-unquote college ready, but we take the time and effort to get them ready. And many of our students still get associate degrees. We still offer an associate degree program. And we have articulation agreements with other institutions to help send them on to larger institutions that may have majors and programs that we don't offer, but we give them the foundation that they need to go into those other programs.
With an enrollment of less than 300, McCorn says,
it's a miracle. And I've often said to the cabinet that I really do think that it is a miracle that Clinton has been able to exist as long as it has with such small enrollment. But one way is that the people who work here are invested. They're invested in the students and invested in the institution and the mission of the institution. So they know they're not going to get rich working at Clinton. So we've been able to keep tuition manageable. We have probably, we're either the second or third most affordable or least expensive HBCU in the country. Right now, you could go to Clinton, tuition, room and board for under $20,000 a year, which is pretty remarkable. Our residence halls, we can accommodate about 150 students on campus, and we don't charge a lot for room and board, which keeps it affordable. And, we've just been able to make it work. Our endowment is low, but our hope is to get that up. We're right around $1 million, which is real small for a school. But our hope is with our next capital campaign to triple the endowment and to create more funds for scholarship money for our students.
Clinton College is also working to become
the 10th federally recognized work college in the country. A work college, Berea College, which many people, your listeners, will be familiar with Berea. Berea has been around for a long time. They started probably 100 years ago providing an option for their students to work to pay their tuition. Berea was in a more agrarian community, so they worked the farm and other agricultural kinds of jobs, and then that paid off their tuition. They've evolved over the years, so they offer different kinds of jobs, but a combination of internships and externships cover their tuition and fees. And the federal government saw that as a viable option for higher education going forward and designated 8 other schools as work colleges. So there are 9 right now in the country and only one HBCU, Paul Quinn in Dallas is a work college. President Michael Sorrell, who's a phenomenal leader, took the risk of moving Paul Quinn in a different direction. When he got there, he turned the football field into a farm. And people thought he was crazy. And it's working. And so President Sorrell is now developing what he calls an urban work college consortium. So it's a consortium within a consortium, and we are part of the first group of that Urban Work College Consortium. And our hope is that that will fast track us, because it takes about 2 years to get the federal designation. So working with Paul Quinn will kind of put us on the fast track. So hopefully within the next year or so, we will become a federally recognized work college, where our students will be able to basically, through positions on campus and off campus, be able to pay their tuition. And of course, it requires partnerships from corporations who will not only invest in the program, but will offer positions to our students so that they get life skills, job skills, career development to give them employment while they're on campus. And the hope is that when they graduate, they'll have a full-time job.
McCorn says, despite all of the good that's happening at Clinton, there is room for improvement.
My slogan that's kind of caught on around here is excellence without excuse, right? So when I, and I don't know if you heard this from other HBCU presidents, if they were transparent enough about this, but the continuing dilemma of HBCUs is that a lot of our excellence is hit and miss. Right, people get frustrated, and I know when I was a student at Morehouse, there were times I said, once I get out of here, I'm never coming back. I'm never giving any money to this school because of the way I was treated or the experiences that I had. And unfortunately, because we do so well in some areas, we take some areas for granted around customer service and the way we treat people, because students are customers, right? The way we talk to them and to their parents. So I've been striving now to make that part of the culture of the campus, that we consider everything we do, number one, that we are a student-ready campus, which means that we have empathy and intentionality about how we deal with our students, right? So that everyone has to be an educator, from the administration down to the janitorial staff, that everyone sees themselves as an educator, and that we interact with our students with respect and mutuality and dignity. And so that is, quite frankly, a challenge to get the entire campus to move in that direction. But it has to start with the leadership, right? So I'm trying to exemplify that and demanding that of my cabinet that meets in this very room every Monday. We're actually reading together a book called Becoming a Student-Ready College. We're reading it together, we're studying it, we're talking about it every week, and we're charging every single division and department of the school to drill down and do it with all of their staff.
The history of South Carolina's HBCUs is a profound and valuable one, from providing a place of higher learning for Black Americans to shaping the outcomes of the Civil Rights Movement, and today, making it possible for a diverse group of students to attend and successfully master college. In the beginning of this report, Dr. Bobby Donaldson, a professor at the University of South Carolina, spoke about the history of these schools. In our conversation, he also talked about the university's current exhibit, Justice for All, South Carolina and the American Civil Rights Movement.
That young man there in that photograph on the banner, he was the president of the student government at Allen University in 1960-61. This gentleman in the middle is now in his mid-80s, named Jim Covington. He was a reporter filming the demonstrations in Orangeburg in 1960, and he was beaten while he was down there filming, even though he's a white journalist. The gentleman in the front of this demonstration is named Dr. Benjamin Glover. And in 1960-63, he was the pastor of Mother Emanuel AME Church. Part of the we know about civil rights is that people like Covington were told not to cover it. They did not want to magnify the situation. The assumption for many is that if you cover this in a minimal way, it will go away. And so ironically, a lot of people, when they think about civil rights, South Carolina does not come quickly to mind. It is not on the same level as Alabama, Mississippi, but obviously, I mean, there were clearly events happening. that only more recently have been more fully recognized.
The exhibit, Justice for All, South Carolina and the American Civil Rights Movement, aims to change that narrative.
It's an effort to delve deeply into the resources of the University of South Carolina's libraries and to identify stories we know well, like the Orangeburg Massacre, and stories we don't know as well, and to put those materials on display for the broader public. Many of these things remain hidden in boxes in our archives. And so for 6 months, we have the material out for display. So you will find information about the downtown protests in Orangeburg. You will find information about a woman named Sarah Mae Fleming, a 19-year-old who challenges bus segregation in Columbia in 1954, 17 months before Rosa Parks. You will find material about a young man named Isaac Woodard, who was a World War II veteran who comes home in February of 1946 and is blinded in a racial assault in Batesburg, South Carolina. And so many of these stories we have some familiarity with, but now the public has a chance to literally see the material for themselves.
In a tour of this part of the exhibit, Dr. Donaldson explains to me why some people would like to consider the University of South Carolina an HBCU.
Now, do you know the early history of this university? So when we talk about historically black colleges, we now made the contention that one of the earliest historically black colleges was the University of South Carolina.
Yeah.
Yes. Let me show you. I'll show you what I mean
okay.
by that. So did you realize that in Reconstruction, the campus was 90% African American?
I didn't know the numbers were that high.
Yeah. So, yeah. So this is the case about Reconstruction. So the first African American professor, that's his diploma when he graduates from law school. And this is a photograph of some of the early students on the campus who were being trained to be teachers in the 1870s. But what's ironic is this history was largely erased. And so you look at this book, it kind of says Negro regime, and there's a blank spot. Justice for All exhibit is open in the Hollings Library Monday through Friday from 9 to 5 o'clock p.m. There are also special occasions on the weekends where an open house takes place. There is one on February 16th and another on March the 22nd. The one on February 16th looks at the role of African-American photography in the Civil Rights Movement. That will be led by Cecil Williams of Orangeburg. And then in March, there's a special Saturday open gallery that will be led by Dr. Bill Hine, who is a retired professor at South Carolina State. And he will be here talking about his book on the history of South Carolina State, but also on the critical role of historically black colleges in the Civil Rights Movement.
Thank you for joining us for this special report, The Road We Trod, a look at South Carolina's historically black colleges and universities and the impact they've had on history, the economy, and the future. You're listening to South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Felicia Eadie.